AIM with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 28th, 2004. Obscene wealth and grinding poverty, the face of capitalist America. Today on Taking AIM. Recently, three reports were published that focus on this topic. Hidden Slaves, Forced Labor in the United States, published by the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley and Free the Slaves, a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C. Tens of thousands of people at any time in the United States are forced to work against their will through threats or violence. Forced labor occurs in at least 90 cities across the country, but most concentrated in immigrant communities in California, Florida, New York, and Texas. At the other end of the spectrum, the Forbes magazine published its list of the 400 richest Americans, a snapshot of the financial oligarchy. Foremost among them, Microsoft's Bill Gates, with a net worth of $48 billion. Close behind him, Warren Buffett, with $41 billion. In the same week that Forbes published the list of the 400 richest Americans, Citizens for Tax Justice issued its report entitled "Corporate Income Taxes in the Bush Years." Their study looked at the taxes paid by 275 companies listed on the Fortune 500, the largest corporations in America from 2001 to 2003 that reported profits in each of the 3 years. 82 of the 275 companies, almost a third of the total, paid zero, I repeat, zero or less in federal income taxes in at least one of those years. Ralph.
Maya, What Strategy to Fight Global Capitalism was the title of an address I made to the Open World Congress in 1998. And I mention that because the data that we cited there bears considerable relevance to the new Forbes report. In the United States, the New York Times estimated that one-half of 1% of the population owned more than the rest of the population combined, wrote the New York Times on February 15, 1998. The top executives of eight companies owned personally $15 billion of their company's equity. And at that time, the New York Times published the executive summary of an in-depth study and report prepared by the University of Michigan under the title "Rich Control More of U.S. Wealth as Debts Grow for Poor." And the University of Michigan study just showed that wealth had become more concentrated in the United States than ever before. Now, this was in 1998 under Clinton. And in fact, that concentration of power, which was demonstrated in the Forbes study of that day, is reflected as well in the U.S. Census Bureau report that confirmed, quote, "The gap between the affluent few and everyone else is wider than it has been since the end of World War II." And the New York Times again commented, "Each indicator has shown a pronounced increase in the gap between the incomes of the wealthy and those of the poor and the working class," unquote. And the United States Census Bureau report stated that in the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, the share of national income claimed by the top 5% grew at a faster rate than in the previous 8 years combined of the Reagan administration. I think we need to emphasize that, particularly as we begin to look at the current situation. And the Census Bureau report in that time, 1998, the widening disparity in the fortunes of American workers is an entrenched fixture of the country's economy. At that time, Forbes magazine disclosed that the top corporate rulers controlled $3.2 trillion in business assets alone. They owned 50% of all common stock in America and 45% of all fixed non-residential private capital in the United States. That was then. It's become increasingly worse since.
Well, let's look at the situation today as Forbes did. The admission price, they say, to be on their list of the 400 richest Americans is a mere $750 million. 78% of the people on this year's list are billionaires. What does it mean to have a combined net worth of these wealthiest people in the United States of $1 trillion? The figure of $1 trillion may be difficult for you and me and Ralph to comprehend, but if we put it in perspective, if you divide that sum by $10,000, there would be 100 million portions. That means one in three people living in the United States could receive a check of $10,000 if the 400 richest Americans care to dispose of their wealth. We know they're not going to do that, but think of what $1 trillion is. $1 trillion is also approximately equal to the gross domestic product of the nation of Canada. Their GDP is $957 billion. California, facing a massive budget deficit, their deficit is $40 billion. $40 billion less than the wealth of Bill Gates.
Well, Maya, $1 trillion can be measured in so many ways. It's approximately the amount spent on the military throughout the world, nearly two-thirds of which is spent in the United States. But another measure of what $1 trillion represents is the following. It's $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus. You see, what we're really talking about here is a concentration of wealth of such enormous size, it actually is of a greater disparity. When we look in a moment at what poverty is in the United States, what the so-called poverty wage is relative to this wealth, the concentration in the hands of a tiny number of people in this country of billions of dollars and actually trillions of dollars is a greater disparity in wealth than existed at the time of the French Revolution, that existed at the time of the revolution in China in 1949, that existed certainly at the time of the American Revolution in the 18th century. These disparities are a function of extreme injustice, extreme pauperization, extreme oppression, and extreme exploitation. And we had a language in this country that derived from the experience of that 18th century struggle against autocracy. It was the language of entitlement of the many, and it was the language of revolution. And that revolutionary discourse today is part of what we supposedly celebrate on July 4th. But these disparities that we're now describing to you dwarf what the condition was in the 18th century that spawned a revolution for liberty, for democratic control, and for self-determination.
Let's look at the wealth of William Henry Gates III, founder of Microsoft. His wealth, $48 billion, is more than 40% of the U.S. population combined. That is, more than 120 million people. Warren Buffett, close behind, as I mentioned, with $41 billion. Then number three is Paul Gardner Allen, who co-founded Microsoft and built it before he left with Bill Gates. We have tying for number three, five people. All five are part of the Walton family. They are the children of Walton, who started Walmart, the largest private employer in the United States, becoming soon throughout the world, and notoriously anti-union and using sweatshop labor buying products and selling them sweatshop labor products. Walmart, they is in positions of 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. 9 is Michael Dell of the Dell Computer Fortune. And again, computers are with positions 10 and 11, with Lawrence Ellison of Oracle in 10 and Stephen Ballmer of Microsoft again in 11. So you have in the top 11 positions three people from Microsoft. Now, all of Gates' fortune is not only in Microsoft. As Forbes notes, He methodically diversifies his wealth, selling 20 million shares of Microsoft each quarter. That means four times a year, or 80 million shares of Microsoft he divests each year and reinvests it in non-technological companies, in other words, maintaining control over companies such as Cascade Investment, Cox Communications, the Canadian National Railway, and others. Ralph?
Maya, I want to look at this as it's described by the University of the Poor, which is a research campaign conducted by the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Organization. And these are the investigative results of June 2001. We'll move back and forward in recent time because what comes upon us is the extraordinary increase in concentration of wealth. Remember what we were just citing from 1998. Look how it jumps by June 2001. 490 billionaires by June 2001. The billionaires represented 1/100,000th of 1% of the United States population. 1/100,000th of 1% have this vast, vast concentration and monopoly of wealth. Now talk about autocracy. Talk about a wholly undemocratic structure of power. Talk about a control of society, a purchase of the political process. It can be no more clearly expressed by this number. 1/100,000th of 1% of our people in this country have total command over the economic life of our society, its governance, and the state apparatus itself. The combined wealth of just 269 of the billionaires accounted for more than the entire GDP, gross domestic product, at a level of 30%. The richest 1% of the population owned three times more than the bottom 90% in 2001. And the report continues, wealth is now more concentrated than in any other previous time. There is a magnitude of oppression and of exploitation that is expressed here that, as I say, cannot find an analog in prior systems of feudal exploitation, of extreme oppression and autocracy that were the bedrock for revolutionary overthrow in those societies.
Ralph, as Marie Antoinette supposedly said, let them eat cake. Well, Forbes also did a feature called The Cost of Being Rich, and this is all available on the Internet. Looking at the goods and services that the super rich purchase, for instance, a Ferrari 612 starts at $255,000, or a Russian sable coat at Bloomingdale's, nonetheless, is $160,000. A pair of Gucci shoes, only $395, but a pair of men's black calf wingtips, custom made by John Loeb of London, $3,565. Of course, if you want to send your child to school and you're not able to get a scholarship because your income puts you among the 400 wealthiest people in the United States, Groton, a year for preparatory school of tuition, room, and board is $35,800, more than most people in the United States make. Harvard, one year of tuition, room, board, and insurance is $39,880. And for those who appreciate culture, two season tickets at the Metropolitan Opera for Saturday night in a parterre box, $4,720 for the super rich.
Here's a study by Edward N. Wolfe, Recent Trends in Wealth Ownership, that pertained to the year 2000. At that time, 1% of Americans owned as much wealth as the bottom 95%. The total wealth of the top 60% of Americans was 500 times the total wealth of the remainder of society. The bottom 40% of households owned 1/5 of 1%, or 0.2% of the nation's wealth, while Bill Gates had more wealth than 40% of the United States population combined, or 120 million people. And United for a Fair Economy, Reporting on executive excess report, CEO pay soars at companies that send jobs overseas, adds another important dimension to this on August 31st, 2004. Of the super rich, those who are most rewarded are, quote, the CEOs at companies that outsource the most U.S. jobs to the sweatshops of the world. It is these CEOs who are rewarded with the largest paychecks, according to a new report, Executive Express 2004, and is correlated as well to campaign contributions to the Republican and Democratic parties. Outsourcing, unexpensed stock options, and rising CEO pay is the subheading. The average CEO compensation at the 50 largest U.S. corporations that outsource the most jobs increased by 46% in 2003. The top outsourcers earned an average of an increment of $10.4 million per individual, 28% more than the average CEO compensation at $8.1 million. And the political contributions paid off in particular. CEOs of the 69 companies that funded the Republican and Democratic national conventions had a jump of 52% in their respective pay.
Well, Ralph, that leads right into the Citizens for Tax Justice report, corporate income taxes in the Bush years, where I mentioned before that 82 of the 275 companies, almost a third of the total, paid zero or less in federal income taxes. In the years that they paid no income taxes, these companies reported $102 billion in pre-tax U.S. profits. And instead of paying taxes, they often received tax rebates, and that totaled $12.6 billion. Now, the nominal tax rate, the nominal federal tax rate on profits for large corporations is 35%. 35%. But remember, they were paying zero or getting rebates. And if you calculate out on the basis of what they did pay, the 275 companies total, this is including the third that paid none plus the others that paid, the effective tax rate for these corporations over the 3 years as studied by Citizens for Tax Justice is 18.4%, nowhere near the 35%. In other words, there is a massive transfer of the cost of the federal government and the services, but primarily the military-industrial complex, from corporations to the working poor of this country.
Well, now, just look at this, Maya. In this study about CEO compensation amongst these billionaires, the report tells us that the corporations that claimed an estimated $3.9 billion in tax deductions were then involved in granting wholesale stock options to the 350 leading CEOs. The CEO paid worker ratio reached 301-1 by 2003. Now, in actual terms, the average CEO pay was 56 times more than that of the United States Army General. Well, that puts in perspective what the military-industrial complex really is. Because even the generals of the enforcement arm of U.S. capitalism are hired hands, nothing more than flunkies on a nominal pay compared to that which their masters receive. The Executive Excess Report of 2004 profiles the CEO practices and political contributions for the 15 major companies that outsource the most U.S. service jobs: United Technologies, Citigroup, Oracle, Bank of America, Cognizant Technology Solutions, Morgan Stanley, Intuit, SBS Communications, Conseco, JP Morgan, Chase, Sprint, Bank of New York, Time Warner, General Electric, and American Express. They were cutting thousands of U.S. jobs in the process of outsourcing, and just consider the following. The outsourcing of these jobs led to a pay gap between U.S. CEOs and American workers of 400-1. But the gap between the U.S. CEOs and the sweatshop workers to whom they were outsourcing jobs was 3,348-1. Now we get a measure of what the sweatshop and the mad race to the bottom is really about, the pitting of workers against each other as we are all driven down to desperate poverty as the concentration of capital reaches obscene heights.
companies are awarded vast government contracts. They are paying no federal income taxes. Some of these are ITT Industries, Prudential Financial, Unisys, the computer giant, Boeing, Floor Daniel, and CSX. CSX, by the way, is the company that was headed by Treasury Secretary John Snow. The corporate tax receipts are at their lowest in the 20 years as a proportion of the economy. As I said, there has been a shift from who is paying taxes, and the burden is on us. It is on the working poor. The Detroit News had a front page article on the results of its own investigation, and it was headlined, "Working Poor Suffer Under the Bush Tax Cuts." Quote, "The Bush administration and Congress have scaled back programs that aid the poor to help pay for the $600 billion in tax breaks that went primarily to those who earn more than $288,800 a year. The affected programs, job training, housing, higher education, and an array of social services that provide the safety nets for the poor." Now, what the Detroit News is studying is the individual income tax, the tax bill that was recently passed by both the Senate and the House on September 3rd by the Senate by a near unanimous vote of 92-3, and the House on the same day by the margin of 339-65. Notably, two Democrats were missing from the vote. Both Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry and Vice presidential candidate John Edwards, they didn't show up to vote. They cast their ballot essentially for this tax bill that shifts the burden to the poor and wealth to the wealthy.
Maya, it's not only John Kerry and John Edwards who, of course, are an emblem and a symbol of what the real role of the Democratic Party is. The overwhelming majority of Democratic senators and congressmen voted with the Republicans to sustain the $146 billion tax cut, as you report. The near unanimous vote that you cite of 92-3 was matched in the House by 339-60. What that means is that, as the New York Times itself acknowledged, millions of American families are being squeezed, falling incomes, rising health costs, while the tax cuts are handed out to these very corporations whose obscene profits know no limits. And that, in fact, is the project of U.S. Capitol and its two political parties. There is no way to square that circle, brothers and sisters. This is an election year. This is nominally the time when the supposed populist rhetoric of the Democratic Party is to differentiate itself from the Republican Party. It does not. It has not. For 40 years, there has not been a single piece of legislation that has passed the Congress of the United States involving any single social reform. Not since 1963 has there been even a nominal piece of legislation that has any pretended benefit to those who are working for a living in the United States.
Ralph, even the bourgeois press, as we've noted with the Detroit News and the Washington Post, note the increasing disparity and poverty in the United States. Last August 27th in the Washington Post, poverty rate up third year in a row. More also lack health coverage. Quote, in an article by Cecily Connolly and Griff White, the number of Americans living in poverty or lacking health insurance rose for the third straight year in 2003, the Census Bureau announced, reflecting a job market that failed to match what they call an otherwise strong economic growth. Overall, the median household income was $43,318. It was stagnant, but the national poverty rate rose to 12.5%, 35.9 million. And by the end of 2003, 12.9 million children were living in poverty. 45 million people are without health insurance, and these are primarily white adults, primarily in the South, and these account for the increase. In the later part of the show, we are going to discuss this increase. an additional 1.3 million Americans fell below the poverty line in 2003 with the supposed strong economic growth, and the incomes dipped for the poorest 20% of the population. In other words, they were already below the poverty line, and those below the poverty line saw their income dip lower.
But Maya, that's a measure of what this incredible betrayal of the American people represents by this Democratic Party support for the Republican extension. The bill extends to 2009. The tax breaks for the wealthy occur on the eve of the coming election, as I mentioned. $13 billion in additional business tax breaks have been incorporated. Another $22.6 billion of benefit for upper-income layer of the population. The tax cut legislation has a second purpose, because, as the New York Times acknowledges, besides continuing the looting of the federal treasury by the wealthy, this first Kerry term, if there's a Kerry victory, through 2008, will be confronted by this additional tax break for the wealthy that will provide an enormous built-in deficit that will be a fixture throughout the entire first term of Kerry. What that means is that any pretext of any kind of health care initiative, as the New York Times acknowledges, will be scrapped the minute the man takes office. So let's be clear about what these tax cuts represent. They are a guarantee to the banks, the corporations, the rich, and the ruling class that there will be nothing given to the poor, nothing given to the working class, no break on the constant destruction of social services, no end or even limit on the elimination of pensions and health care and the rating of Social Security and the end of any kind of affordable housing and the destruction of our school system in the United States, and forget a living wage in this country, which was just vetoed, by the way, in California by Arnold Schwarzenegger under the advice of Warren Buffett, the chief political and economic advisor to both Schwarzenegger and John Kerry.
The number two of the Forbes wealthiest individuals in the United States. As for advances made by women, forget it in the workplace. Women made 76 cents for every dollar earned by men in 2003, and down from what they earned in 2002, where it was still below what men earned, but 77 cents for every dollar. Hispanics, Latinos, median income dropped 2.6% last year, and Asian Americans were hit hardest, according to the census data. Ralph, we will be returning in a moment after this station identification.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Maya, I want to just mention the report by the Citizens for Tax Justice, a liberal policy group, which is actually partially funded by the AFL-CIO. With respect to this new tax break that's been voted by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in Congress, the effective tax rate for the 275 of the largest U.S. corporations has been dropped another 20%, along with a rise in pre-tax profits of 26%. 82 of the 275 companies, all members of the Fortune 500, paid zero or less in federal income tax, as you say, but 71% of all corporations, including those specifically with fake offices in Bahamas or the Cayman Islands, paid no taxes whatsoever. You mentioned, Maya, that 45% of the 45 million Americans are without any health care at all. 50 million additional Americans have partial health care that does not cover their major needs, their major requirements in any health emergency. In essence, health care is being scrapped in this country. The corporate tax receipts are their lowest level in 20 years. The 275 companies had trillions of dollars in profits, and they paid next to nothing, barely half of the rate that they had paid previously, those companies that pay taxes. Well, who are the largest winners in this? With loopholes and tax subsidies that cut taxes for these giant corporations. General Electric, the biggest winners. $9.5 billion in tax refunds. SBC Communications, $9 billion. Citigroup, IBM, Microsoft, AT&T, ExxonMobil, and Verizon. billions of rebates for these people. Who do you think funds the two parties? All of these companies have contributed to both. The industry that recorded the lowest effective tax rate, naturally, aerospace and defense, which profited enormously from the new defense contracts fueled by the Bush administration with the support of Congress's so-called war on terror. And these, the same weapons industry paid 1.6% of its profits in federal income tax over the past 3 years. 1.6%. It's not even a token. That's the real structure of power in this society. That's the real class war, which the super rich wage upon the mass of our people because it's an expression of a system in terminal crisis, in terminal decay, in terminal incapacity to even pretend to meet the most elementary needs of the mass of our people in this society.
Today on Taking Aim, we're discussing obscene wealth and grinding poverty, the face of capitalist America. One aspect of poverty is usually discussed as existing outside the United States, not here within our borders, and that is slavery. Slavery supposedly abolished after the Civil War. Hidden Slaves, Forced Labor in the United States is a provocative report, and it is available on the Internet at the website of the University of California, Berkeley's Human Rights Center. It is a joint report prepared by the Human Rights Center and a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C. called Free the Slaves. According to this report, in 90 cities across the country and concentrated in California, Florida, New York, and Texas, there are slaves, slave labor, many of them immigrants brought to the United States for prostitution, for working in sweatshops, restaurants, hotels, and in the agricultural industry.
Domestic service, sweatshop factories, restaurants and hotel work, and as you say, agriculture increasingly in the United States.
Now, this report specifies at least 10,000 people are forced to work against their will through threats or violence at any given time. But they say this is vastly underestimated, that there are actually tens of thousands of people working in slave conditions. In fact, a few years ago, in 2000, the Central Intelligence Agency released a report. It was actually kept secret, but one person who worked on it leaked the report to the New York Times. Although the report was not a top secret report, the CIA still had not released it. And this was just on the aspect of trafficking in women, holding women in bondage for prostitution, and the estimate there was 50,000 women in the United States at one time, and this is just for trafficking in women. So the estimate of tens of thousands in slavery at any one time is underestimated.
The CIA report that you are describing as reported in the New York Times not only refers to the 50,000 women, but to equivalent numbers of children.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only women who are bonded in slavery and in sex, prostitution through compulsion, but the children are subjected to the same fate as domestic servants, as sex objects sold on the open market through coercion. The scale of human misery indicated, as the report states, is difficult to quantify. Women and children from Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe are lured to the United States with the pretense of jobs or educational opportunities, and they are, quote, forced at gunpoint to work in brothels and sweatshops. Others are born into unspeakable poverty and sold into bondage by their parents. The report, called International Trafficking in Women to the United States, a Contemporary Manifestation of Slavery, reveals not only the growth of slavery alongside staggering levels of wealth for those at the top, but a political and legal system which is not merely indifferent to the problem, but benefiting from it and complicit in it.
This CIA report is still available on the Internet. If you go to a search engine, put in International Trafficking in Women to the United States, and you too can read this full report released by the CIA in 2000. But let's go to the study that was done on human trafficking that was released only last week. As I mentioned, trafficking in is 35 or more countries were noted by the Human Rights Center and Free the Slaves. 35 or more countries trafficking to the United States. China had the largest number of victims, followed by Mexico and Vietnam. Mexican and Vietnamese victims, as I mentioned before, 90 cities. Most of the forced labor is for prostitution and sex services, followed by domestic service, agriculture, sweatshop, factories, restaurant, and hotel work, and, as we mentioned before, agriculture. The problem in discovering the numbers of people and breaking the slave rackets has to do with the lack of enforcement and also the incredible fear of people who are in these conditions. They are threatened physically and emotionally, and once they do come out, they are, for many, in many cases, deported. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the U.S. citizens and foreign nationals who are in the United States who have been brought under these conditions, they are not defined as household workers or as employees under the National Labor Relations Act. They are denied protections, and it restricts their ability to organize for better wages or working conditions, and of course their vulnerability is enormous, because what happens in essence is that if they expose the conditions, the slave conditions and the abuse conditions under which they are held, they are subject to immediate deportation, and deportation following prolonged imprisonment. So they are in a system of terror. Terror that obligates them to keep quiet about their sex servitude and their slave circumstances.
Let's look at some of the case studies that are within the report. Kil Su Lee, sweatshop workers in American Samoa, where there are many garment factories. Now, Kil Su Lee used employment contract fees and penalties to trap the workers into remaining. He kept his workers locked in the factory compound, withheld food as punishment, and authorized violent retaliation, beatings, assaults, and rape. Lakaridi Bali Reddy is a famous case here in the Bay Area. He was a local businessman, a very wealthy Indian, and the case came to light after one of the women that he had imprisoned in and had working in his restaurants in Berkeley died. He had exploited several young girls from his native village in India, where he was noted for his wealth. And the sex and labor exploitation went on for over 15 years. 15 years. And he himself raped and sexually abused his victims, as well as forcing them to work in his business, which is a very well-established Indian restaurant here in the Bay Area. Victoria Farms, JB Farm Labor Contractor, sometimes farmers, they separate themselves. They distance themselves from the actual bondage labor because they hire these farm labor contractors. In the California asparagus harvest, there were hundreds of people forced to work and pick these very high-priced vegetables in substandard conditions for virtually no pay. They were recruited from Mexico. They were powerless to stop and to escape because in the transport from Mexico, they had accumulated debt, and these debts were taken from their weekly paycheck. It was only when some of them escaped and that a civil case was filed against the JB Farm Labor Contractor and Victoria Island Farms that these workers were paid and the case came to light. Ralph.
Well, Maya, as we cite these egregious examples of these essential slave masters who are the middlemen in bringing these victims into the United States, we should not ignore the fact that this study, Hidden Slaves, Forced Labor in the United States, makes an extremely critical and salient point. Quote, industry pressures on United States textile and clothing manufacturers are encouraging, in fact mandating employers, to to locate factories in close proximity to retailers. When the producers are in the United States, they are competing with low-wage manufacturers in other countries, often owned by U.S. corporations. So, quote, most of the United States garment and textile industry, concentrated around New York City and Los Angeles, according to the Union of Needle Trades and Industrial Textile Employees, the U.S. garment and textile industry now has 75% of all New York apparel manufacturing firms as sweatshops. Now, this is coming from the top. 75% of all New York apparel manufacturing firms are sweatshops. It means, quote, forced labor. What we are witnessing here now is the institutionalization at the top of key industries. Agriculture, clothing, manufacture are predicated upon sweatshop conditions, slave conditions. The coyotes we're talking about, who you're citing and are often exposed in the press, are taking the fall for the corporate capital that commands the trillions of dollars. Parenthetically, let me mention, brothers and sisters, Teresa Heinz Kerry and John Kerry own 51 corporations and companies outside the United States. Where do you think that labor is coming from? And what do you think it's paid?
Ralph, let's look at agriculture, which you mentioned. Each year, more than 1.5 million seasonal farm workers cultivate and harvest produce in the United States. Some 700,000 of these workers are migratory, following the harvest. In spite of the expansion in agricultural production, according to the report, farm worker wages and working conditions are stagnant or declining, and like domestic workers, as you cited, the agricultural workers are not employees under the NRLA and don't have protections. So within this, with labor contractors, they not only bring people who are indentured to the farm grower under the legal visa requirements, but they also bring in people who are in slave conditions. One of these was caught. In the 1990s, the farm labor contractors Ramiro, Jose, and Juan Ramos, they supplied labor to the harvest to harvest oranges and other citrus for some of the largest citrus growers in the United States. And between January 2000 and 2001, they forced approximately 700 Mexican and Guatemalan workers to work without pay or for far less than the minimum wage, and this was done under the threat of violence.
The Associated Press reported on May 20th, 2004, that the United States Justice Department has acknowledged that slavery, which was outlawed nominally 130 years ago, is an essential and integral part of the United States economy today. And one of the aspects of this report that the State Department and the Justice Department both have acknowledged is that it's not just in sweatshop conditions in agriculture, it's not just in sweatshop and slave-like conditions in the garment industry and the clothing industry, but this is linked to the, quote, criminal organizations that deal in illicit drugs, weapons, and money laundering, quote, unquote. The United States authorities, the corporations of the United States, are integrally involved with drug smuggling, weapons, and money laundering as part of the sweatshop traffic. It's out and open, it's in your face, it's acknowledged and it's owned up to, and it's not touched.
Obscene wealth and grinding poverty, the face of capitalist America. We have now talked about the obscene wealth, and we have talked about slave labor, and we would like to say parenthetically that you look at part three of our series on prisoners buried alive, because prison labor in the United States is becoming more and more a major factor of forced labor.
In 36 states, Maya, everything from blue jeans to auto parts to electronics and furniture, where people are paid as little as $20 a month in the prison system, to over 2 million prisoners in the United States and the huge Lockheed Technologies Incorporation and the major corporations in the United States are drawing upon forced prison labor, IBM, Compaq, and Dell. This is part of the system of slave labor and sweatshop labor conditions through the criminalization of poverty. In fact, Jimmy Carter passed the Justice System Improvement Act, which granted exemptions from the Ashurst-Summers for seven prison industry enhancement projects, so that now, they, under Jimmy Carter, exemptions were made to 50 state prison systems to use sweatshop and slave labor conditions with the authority of law, which had previously banned these conditions.
We call this forced labor because prisoners don't have control over their own lives, and they can't even get toilet paper or toothpaste unless they purchase it for themselves at high cost, and from which the prison system deducts 25% to 30% for supposed victim programs. Before we close this show, we must address one aspect of grinding poverty, and that who predominantly in this country are the poor, comprise the poor. Studies done in Minnesota and Oregon that you can see on the internet for the Minnesota Budget Project and also compiled in Oregon, the portrait of poverty in Oregon, working poor dominate the poverty rolls. Let's look at this Minnesota Budget Project because as in Minnesota or in Oregon, so these describe conditions in New York and elsewhere. Most poor families are working families. I have to repeat this over and again. Most poor families are working families. Nationally, 70% of poor families are those in which parents are able to work or work. Many of them have worked at least 9.5 months during the year. They may be unemployed at the moment, or they are still employed. What is noted in each of these reports is that if you are earning minimum wage, you are going to be the working poor, and that the minimum wage today buys less than what the minimum wage bought yesterday.
Right. Well, Maya, the Food First fact sheet in 2002, quote, the United States has never grown so much food. Scarcity is down. Food is cheap. Enough food is produced to provide for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Yet in the world's richest nation, over 45 million people experience hunger, and one out of four children. But here is an essential point about all of this discourse about poverty in the United States. I want us to look carefully at what it means to be qualifying for poverty in the United States. In order to be considered to be amongst the working poor, you have to show an income for four people of $17,463.
It's up to $18,000 something now, Ralph.
Yes. Well, in this report of Food First, Maya,
mm-hmm.
it's $4,366 per person for a year. Now think about it. Who in their right mind believes that anybody can survive on $4,366 a year in this society? And yet that is the standard for poverty? We know, therefore, that these figures on poverty are nonsense. What I'm trying to express here is that it is much more than 36 million people, because it is multiples of $4,000 a year that represents poverty in the United States. $17,000 or $18,000 for a four-member family in the United States. $4,366 a person. What about the report of the Washington Post on August 27th of this year? The average poverty line for an individual was $9,393, and for a family of four, as you say, Maya, $18,810. Now that's up to the magnificent sum in 2004 of $4,700 per person. What that means in reality, brothers and sisters, is that poverty is a multiple of these figures. You could multiply 4,000 by 10, multiply it by 20, and you would have a figure that is a requisite for maintaining yourself in this society. Because what does an apartment cost in New York City, brothers and sisters? Think about it. What does your food cost? What does your transportation cost? What does your clothing cost? I'm not even going to talk about health care. I'm not going to even talk about the special needs of children. We're talking about slave conditions, and we're talking about fundamental and institutionalized lies, because poverty is not just for 36 million people or 40 million people. It's for 90 million people in the United States, brothers and sisters, at a minimum. That's what these figures are really telling us.
That is correct, Ralph, because as all the studies that base themselves on the federal poverty guidelines state, affordable housing is not affordable. Working families are unable to afford health insurance. Parents can't go to work until they've secured child care, which is expensive, or there are long waiting lists for publicly subsidized child care. In the United States, also, the majority of low-earning people are in service jobs. And when you look at the jobs that are created in the United States and are being destroyed, the 3 million jobs that are being destroyed primarily are manufacturing jobs, jobs where people earn more than minimum wage. The jobs that are being created and don't keep up, the number of jobs being created has not kept up with the number of people entering the workforce. These jobs are low paying service jobs, which explains why the five members of the Walmart family are on the top of the Forbes 400 wealthiest people.
Maya, there was a very important study done in Oregon called The Portrait of Poverty in Oregon by Theresa Novak, who was a reporter for the Oregon Press. And she reports the following. Up to 70% of the people who are living in poverty in Oregon are the so-called working poor. Now, Oregon is an interesting example, brothers and sisters. Oregon is not a state in which you have New York City, Chicago, St. Louis, or Los Angeles, where there is an inner city in which there is devastation, where there is 60 to 70% unemployment among young black males. No, Oregon does not have the over-exploitation, the super-exploitation of the many. But look at this. 70% of the people who live in poverty in Oregon, what do you think they're making? Under $12,000 a year. Now, who is it that can survive on $12,000 a year, as we indicated? But this is a measure. 47% of all job openings paid less than a minimum wage. Less than what was considered a survival wage for a single adult, according to the University of Washington Policy Center report. And the recent study by the Oregon Employment Department indicated that the richest 20% of Oregon families with children had an average income of $100,000 a year, nearly 20 times more than the average income of the poor and the working population. Oregon.
And to bring it full circle to the tax study, where the corporations don't pay taxes and the wealthy get their enormous tax breaks, the study in Oregon also showed that the poor pay a larger proportion of their incomes in the state and local taxes compared to families in the top 1%, but also that they pay a good deal of the income taxes and the sales taxes. Today on Taking Aim, we covered obscene wealth and grinding poverty, the face of capitalist America. We were only able to just touch the surface of this important topic.
And we will be back with more, brothers and sisters, but this is an account of the state of life in America for the mass of our people, and that's what the Million Worker March is about. Our own agenda, our own fight back, our own willingness to mobilize in our own name on October 17th at the Lincoln Memorial, brothers and sisters. If you understand the meaning of this data, you will see the fate of our people at the hands of this corrupt oligarchy that has usurped our society. Get ready to struggle, brothers and sisters. That's our requirement, and that's what's going to happen. The beginning of a mass movement of resistance, October 17th, Washington, D.C., the Lincoln Memorial.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim at WBAI.org or call us at 707-552-9995. Write to us at Taking Aim, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, that's V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California 94591. And if you'd like to hear this show or any other show of our, in our, they're available on our archive at www.takingaim.info. Copy, CD, or audio cassette are also available. Contact us for information. I'd like to thank Michael G. Haskins today for engineering our program. Next week, we'll be back in the studio, and we'll be with you next week. Thank you.